So if you don't have a walk away position, you're not negotiating. You have to walk away sometimes. If you don't walk away, you'll be selling at a loss.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. My guest today is Derek Arden. Here's three facts I think you should know about Derek. One, he speaks internationally on negotiating and influencing, and he's the author of 10 books, including Win-Win, How to Get a Winning Result from Persuasive Negotiations. Second fact, Derek hosts a live interview show every Monday at lunchtime in London, England, lunchtime Greenwich Mean Time. And he has a podcast channel with over 70 interviews and an executive briefing. And three, he would love to have you as a connection. Most importantly, when you need help to get a better result from your negotiating, then you need Derek Arden. Derek, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Thank you, George. And it's a great pleasure to be with you from London in Toronto. Hugely.
It's always great to reach across the pond.
Absolutely.
Derek, your book is called, one of your books is called Win-Win. And I wonder, and I imagine there are people who wonder, is it really possible to have a win-win negotiation? Isn't that impossible?
Well, of course, it is possible, George, and it depends on where you're coming from and what you want to achieve. So let's say, I like to explain it as a win-win-win. A win for me, a win for you, and a win for our ongoing business relationship, because it costs 7 times more to get a brand new customer than it does to upsell, downsell, cross-sell to an existing customer, or get referral recommendations, etc., etc. Now, it might not be as big a win for you as it is for me, but I can't measure that. I don't know how you're feeling. But if you feel that we've got a good, honest business deal, and I do, then that's all we need, isn't it, to take it forward. So that's what I'm talking about. It's the world goes round by knowing people, networking with people like we're doing, talking to each other. So that's a win-win. Actually, if I feel that, in my English language, you've pulled a farce one on me, and I don't know if that translates across the Atlantic Ocean, then frankly, next time you speak to me, I'm not going to be looking for a win-win. I'm going to look for getting you back. And of course, that's human nature. It's not actually very good, but I'm going to look to get you back. So that's the problem with win-lose negotiation. So that's why the book's called that. And I think it's a great title. It was chosen by Pearson, my book publisher. And there we are. So it's been good fun and it's been doing very well. And George, if I may, it's been translated into Chinese. So there's all this talk about China and the Chinese at the moment everywhere. The Chinese have it. And so I'm really proud of that. So thanks for mentioning it. I really appreciate it.
Derek, where did you first learn to negotiate? Was it a childhood lesson that your parents taught? Was it a deal that went wrong that maybe it was a girlfriend who gave you a bad time? Where did you learn to negotiate?
Well, George, I was brought up in Northwest London, and that's pretty rough area in the 50s and 60s. So you had to be pretty street savvy around there, but I didn't know that at the time. I joined Barclays Bank, which was a really big financial institution in those days. And I was really interested in training and coaching people. So I did a a lot of that. And then I got promoted into the large corporate area, and I was looking after some big corporate clients. And one of those, it was the third largest retailer in the world after Walmart and Nordstrom, it was Tesco. And I went to negotiate £1 million deal with them. And the finance director said to me, "Derek, if you haven't got a better price than that, you better leave now." And I'd only been in his room a minute. And I was beginning to feel that sweat coming over my brow, because I didn't have a better price. And I did what all salespeople do, talked about the service, the delivery, the product. And he said, "It's about price. If you haven't got a better price, you better leave." And he got up and he ushered me to the door. And I was sitting on the railway station in North London waiting for a train to go back, thinking, I'm not a very good negotiator. I thought I was, like most people do. Most people in business think they're good negotiators, and they probably are intuitively good negotiators. But how good's good enough? And that's the question I asked myself. And I said, it's not good enough, because I'm not in the top league and I need to be. That night I went out and bought a book by the only British guy who'd written a book, generally all written by Americans. I bought a book called Everything is Negotiable. I started reading the book on the train going home, and I realized what I didn't know, I didn't know. I think that's called unconscious incompetence in psychology. So, and so from that point on, I thought this is going to be a very interesting subject to teach. And I found out that my boss didn't know what I knew. My boss's boss didn't know what I knew. And because I was fronting up the negotiations, they kept promoting me. They couldn't stop promoting me because I was getting good deals. And it really took off from there. But because I was a teacher, George, I decided that this would be a fabulous subject to teach, particularly when I left Barclays, because I realized that all these people higher up in the organization also weren't very good negotiators. And I found that all along. People say they are, but when you come down to it, they don't understand reading body language. They don't understand the psychology of negotiating tactics. They don't understand about how influence works. And I could go on, and it's probably the subject of another podcast on another day. So that's how that's answers your question. That's how I got into it. And I started becoming passionate about it. And I'm very passionate about it now. And when I left Barclays with a really good negotiated deal, as you would have expected me to if I was studying it, and I knew more than the people that were negotiating with me, I've traveled the world. And I've been to beautiful places in Canada, like Halifax and Toronto and Vancouver and Banff, and brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Love your country.
Derek, when you were reading that book on the train, what was one of the first biggest aha moments for you when you read it and you looked at it and you said, whatever the British expression would be, what an idiot I was.
Yeah, well, it would have been, well, I'll tell you what, George, it was more almost everything, which is, you know, which is a bit of an indictment to me, but I was just looking for it. It's on my bookshelf. But actually, it struck me was the tactics, the psychological tactics, the fact that, you know, I was walked to the door, I was put under huge pressure. He was trying to see if I had a bottom line that I would go to, and did I have it there? Because really, negotiating tactics are there to get you down to your bottom line as fast as possible, or if you're in sheer panic, to get you lower than what your bottom line should be, ignoring your fixed and variable costs and everything else, and just in panic to get the deal. And of course, that's what the very large companies can do. And if you don't walk away, and you have to walk away in negotiations sometimes, or you're not negotiating, if you don't walk away, you could put your business at jeopardy. And this particular deal, we didn't come down, we walked away and we lost the deal. And that was a good conscious decision when we did the numbers. And when I went back to him, I said, no, we can't reduce it. And they moved the account to somebody else who decided to do it at a cheaper price. And we worked out that basically everybody's costs were about the same. That's part of your preparation. And therefore, they were going to lose money on it just for the ego trip of having, you know, this large retailer as a client. Well, having a large retailer as a client doesn't pay your bills, doesn't pay your overheads, etc. So that's what it was. But it was just not one thing. It was just a number of things. I just realized my whole awareness was not on the pace. And so at that point, I then went out and bought every tape. And yes, it was tapes in those days, George. I am that old, before CDs and MP4s, that I could buy from Nightingale Conant, who were the experts on tapes and CDs at that time, and listened to them on the train. Bought myself a Sonny Walkman. People won't know what that is, but a tape player, and listened to it on the train. And I kept waking up to, didn't know that, didn't know this. And that's when I thought it'd be a great subject to teach, because there's no right answer. There's no magic answer.
Derek, is negotiation, what's more important, logic or emotion?
Both. People buy on emotion, but the logic tells you if this is going to be profitable, what the business case is for doing the deal. And the last thing you want to do is do a negotiated deal on emotion. That doesn't make sense for your business. So it's a great question, that logic. But if you remember, and a lot of people will, the work that the psychologist did on the left and right brain, logic works on the left brain, but reading body language and reading the signals works on the right brain. And of course, it's five times more difficult to lie with your body language than it is with the words. So you need to be watching the body language and what people are saying and how they're saying it and their tonality, so that you can make a good, conscious, balanced business decision. And that's the mistakes a lot of people make. They don't do that. They actually make their minds up on emotion, and that could be fatal.
Derek, how can someone prepare for a negotiation? Is there a thought process they should go through? And what are those steps?
Okay, well, the steps I coach people on my programs are, number one, do all your research. So how did this client negotiate before? Who am I negotiating with? Look them up on LinkedIn. Who am I meeting? See their pictures, see their CVs, see what schools they went to, so you can build rapport and connect. Then do your numbers. You're not going to make a gigantic profit out of people, are you? You just need to make a good, honest profit to run your business. Then I would mind map all the facts. Yeah, I'm a great mind mapper. Chapter 10 of Win-Win is all about mind mapping, brainstorming, etc. I'd mind map all the facts. Then I'd list it into an agenda, and the agenda would be structured with the difficult things, the pricing maybe at point six and seven. So point one would be background, what are the issues, etc. And the more difficult things would be halfway down the agenda, because you want to get momentum. You want to get agreement. You want to get yeses. And once you get momentum in sport, in baseball, in any ice hockey, once you get momentum, you start winning. Momentum creates momentum. You don't want to get stuck on number one. What's your price? Like I did in Tesco's. And then the other thing as part of this, the last thing, is to decide what's the best position you want to achieve. What's the target position? What's the walk away position? Some people call that a BATNA, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And what's your alternative position? If you do walk away from the deal, what's the alternative? What are you going to do with the resources? What are you going to do with the people? Are you going to put them onto marketing to find more profitable clients, or are you going to close the business down? Actually, it's the alternative position, which is the same as the BATNA. I got that slightly wrong for the technical people listening to this. Forgive me.
Is it important to always have a walkaway position?
Yes, it is. But the walkaway position can change, George, when the facts change. So when you ask questions, you listen to the answers, something else comes up, then you clearly should change those. If you don't have a walkaway position, you're not negotiating. You have to walk away sometimes. If you don't walk away, you'll be selling at a loss. Selling at a loss means you won't have a business. And it's the same if you're buying. If people are listening to this thinking about their own negotiations, you know, again, if they're negotiating a car or a house or something, yeah, you need a walkaway position and you need alternatives. And the alternatives might be buying a different car, buying a different house, etc. If you come across like you want to buy that particular thing and there's nothing else in the world, then they know that they don't need to reduce their price more than just giving you something away, just give something away, which is often why you don't want an emotionally involved person actually at the negotiation table. So my wife says to me, oh, if you're going to do that negotiation stuff, I'll go and have a coffee. And that's great, because then she goes away. She doesn't say, oh, that's the car I want to drive, you know, and all the rest of it. And I can say, well, it's between this car and the car down the road. And if I pay that much for it, my wife will go crazy, and you wouldn't want that to happen to me. And that is, of course, the good guy, bad guy routine linked to higher authority. The wife's the higher authority. George, I was doing a seminar this morning to a large bank in the UK, and I was talking to them about how you use higher authority and good guy, bad guy. And a lot of those bank managers weren't very good negotiators, and they couldn't get their head around why you should use higher authority. And they said, well, no, I'm the bank manager, I can make these decisions. And I was saying, no, because if they know you can make decisions, they'll use all the tactics on you. You've got to say, I mean, I've got to look at this with my people. I've got to get it through my people. I've got to go to the committee, the advances committee, the make it up as you go along committee. It doesn't really matter what the committee is, but it's a group of people. It's not your boss, because if it's your boss, they will say, if you can't make decisions, you better get the boss in.
So one, if one says, I can't make the decision, I've got to talk to the committee, it's better to say the committee versus my boss or the director or the president.
Yeah. I mean, not for a small amount. Of course, I think they were getting confused. Not for a small amount. You can't do that. You could say something like, well, this is priced below our pricing guidelines, so I'll probably get into trouble for this, but because we get on so well, George, I'll have a go at that because of you, because of our relationship. And that's almost applying the Gialdini principle of reciprocity, which I'm sure people on your podcast have probably heard about, you know, giving something away for nothing and getting liked back for it.
So giving something. So now that's one. The question is that one tactic that is useful to get to appear to give something and then look for something in return?
Yeah, there's two things here that when you're reading books on psychology and negotiation and influencing. Number one is you give something that doesn't cost you very much for nothing, then the person owes you something back. So an example might be a small gift, a pen with a logo on it or something like that, or even remembering some things about the client, you know, where they went on holiday. Last time we met, George, I remember it was May the 21st. You were going to the Rockies for a holiday. How was it? You know, how did your kids, John and Paul, get on, or something like that? You know, I keep copious notes of everything every day in my master book, so I can look back, and I've got a good memory. I will remember it was about May, look for my notes, and there'll be notes there. So when we meet, I can remember that. That's a hugely powerful. The other thing on negotiating is when you get into bargaining, when you're getting into the more sort of Donald Trump kind of negotiations, the hardball, I used to call it John Wayne, let's call it Donald Trump now. You know, it's like the first person to blink loses, the first person to give something in loses. No, I don't agree with that. Give something small, get the ball rolling, get some momentum, something that doesn't cost you very much, and get it going. Not something that's really material, but just get the negotiations moving. All this hardball stuff is win-lose, in my opinion. But we are a bit softer this side of the Atlantic Ocean than a typical US negotiator, from my research.
Now, Derek, there are some people, perhaps like your wife, who didn't want to have any part of it. There are some people who are reluctant to negotiate ever.
Yep.
They just tell me the price and I'll pay it. You know, if it's in my budget, I'll pay it. Why do you think people are reluctant? Those people are reluctant to negotiate. What do they think? It's a terrible thing to do.
No, they don't like conflict, basically. So if you ran a psychometric on them, they'd be an accommodator, somebody who wants to agree with people, don't like any conflict, and therefore there must be conflict in negotiation. And that's what I do a lot of work for the health service over here. And a lot of people in the health service are very nice people and they don't like conflict. But you have to create a bit of conflict. If you're selling something for X and I say, George, I can't pay X, I can only pay Y. We have immediately got a bit of conflict there. So I run a model called the Thomas Kilman conflict model on people when I'm doing that. That's the workbook for it. It's a very simple psychometric and it shows whether people are competitive, who like to negotiate, shows whether they're an accommodator or they avoid negotiation. And I would say that more than 50% of people will avoid it. And a lot of people don't like it. And I don't like conflict. It's not normal to like conflict. You've got a bit of a problem if you like it. But what you can do is say something like, well, George, that's a bit more expensive than I've got in my budget, a bit more expensive than I was expecting to pay, say it, dropping your voice, to get this deal done. George, what can you do to help me? And shut up. And I just, I sometimes just put my finger to my lips to remind myself not to say anything when you ask a good quality open question like, what can you do to help me? Then you shut up. You don't keep talking and make it easy for the other person. And the other thing I teach people to do is to teach them to flinch. Now, what do I mean by a flinch? I mean, you tell me the price and I go, that's a bit more expensive than I was expecting to pay. And a sharp intake of breath together with a little head scratch at the same time. Yep, that's it. Wow, it's a bit more expensive than I was expecting to pay. What can you do to help me, etc.? And of course, the very famous flinch was at the United Nations when President Khrushchev of Russia banged the table with his shoe at with President Kennedy. And you can find that clip on YouTube, a really bad video clip. But of course, what he was doing was they noticed that when he never took his shoe off to bang the table, he brought his assistant had brought a shoe, passed it under the table and bang the shoe. And of course, half the world, banging the table with a shoe is a massive insult. And showing the soles of your feet is a massive insult. In the Far East and in UAE and in Saudi Arabia and places like that, so we do have to be very careful with the cultures. So
That banging the table with a shoe was a prepared tactic, and so one doesn't in negotiating a car or a house or a contract, we probably shouldn't take our shoes off and bang the table, but you're suggesting some dramatic gesture is a good way to do what to the negotiation? What does that do?
Well, I'm not really suggesting that we or any of the listeners should do a dramatic gesture, but you need to know about them, because if someone does one on you, then you need to say to yourself, oh, okay, that's interesting. I wonder why they're doing that. You know, maybe move back. What I'm suggesting is you might do a little flinch. So that flinch is the word I use. And you just take a sharp, you might just move back and go, that's a bit expensive. I wasn't expecting to pay that. And then you might do a little bit of Columbo, you know, Peter Falk, the actor in the Columbo series. You're probably too young to remember that, George, but, I can't quite understand that, George. Maybe I made my notes wrong or something, but I thought you said you wanted a win-win and now you're proposing a very high price. So, you know, just those sort of soft, what I call soft psychological negotiation tactics, not bullying, not intimidating people, not threatening them, which I call Shark Tank tactics, just soft psychological tactics, trying to get a win-win, trying to make sure your price is honest and my price is honest. And there we go. Yeah. Yeah.
Now I noticed those phrases you use struck me as quite clever, and negotiating well, being soft and accommodating at the same time. I'm guessing those phrases just don't automatically come to mind, that you've worked on them. Do you recommend that before one goes into a negotiation, one might sit down and rehearse some of those phrases so that you can deliver them in what appears to be natural, as opposed to reading them off your notes?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And picking out ones that actually work for you, George, because I say to people when I'm coaching them on this, pick something that works in your language that you feel comfortable with. Don't take mine. So in Win-Win, I've written a number of these sort of phrases. So for people to pick out ones that that work for them. But the other thing I would say is when you do that, it's good to drop your voice with soft tonality, slow your voice down a bit. I'm speaking from the world of NLP now, neurolinguistics, and just go, and I might lean in. Sometimes I would lean in. I might just lean in and say, it's a bit more expensive than we were expecting to pay, George. What can you do to help me? Now, the way the reptilian brain works is it hears the noise like animals do, the noise we're making. So if I go, well, that's a bit more expensive than I was expecting to pay, George, you're more likely to go defensive, close your, fold your arms like I'm doing now, and go, okay, well, now, you know, I'm setting up for a competition, as opposed to dropping my voice and just saying, anything you can do to help me there, George, would be really helpful, because my boss, my people, have to get this approved by the committee. And at that price, it's underneath what we can make money on. So I really appreciate it if you could go away and give it some thought. See the difference in the voice tonality and the style. And I would be mirroring it. I can't see where your arms are, George, but I'd be mirroring your body language, mirroring your tone of voice, mirroring the words that you're using. In good rapport building style, straight from the work of Bandler and Grindler in the first place, the NLP gurus.
So what's interesting, you're saying no, but you're doing it in almost a vulnerable manner.
Yeah. I think that's a good description of it. I'm not vulnerable. I'm saying no. I mean, it's how you say no, which is probably, we're saying no, but we can find a way around this very easily. I don't suppose you get to hear much of the Brexit negotiations that are going on between the UK and Europe at the moment. We've left the European Union, but the deal has to be signed, and we're trying to do a Canadian style deal apparently. But you know, each side's been saying, well, if that's it, we're going to walk away, there won't be a deal, which is pretty unhelpful. But because the French are saying that, are driving it, and the French and the Brits don't get on very well when they're negotiating generally over the last 1,000 years, you know, we're coming back and say, well, we're going to leave. But no one believes that, because it will be a total lose-lose if we lost without a trade deal, as Britain and the European Union have about 42% of their trade between the two countries. You know, no one wants a kind of world trade deal. So, you know, a world trade organization deal, which means there's a 10% tariff on everything. So
what are you seeing in that negotiation that a business salesperson buyer can learn from and sharpen their negotiation?
Well, number one is the other side needs to think you will walk away. Okay. If they don't believe you're going to walk away, why do they need to do their price? So that's been going on, but actually you don't want to leave. You need to leave the door open. Number two, you need to leave the door open so you can come back. So there's no point falling out with the other side or upsetting them too much, because, you know, you never know when you might need them, or they might change companies and suddenly this guy's in charge or this lady's in charge of a different company and you're trying to do business with them and you've upset them, fallen out with them. So that's the second thing. The third thing is time's crucial. 80% of the negotiations come in the last 20% of the negotiation time. Now, that's our old friend Wilfredo Pareto, the economist, Italian economist, who noticed that 80% of the assets in Italy were in the hands of 20% of the people, because he wrote books. That became known as Pareto's Law, or the 80-20 rule. Even a guy called Richard Koch, K-O-C-H, has written a book just about the 80-20 rule. And it does seem to apply to most things. So 20% of the items need negotiating, the other 80% probably not very important. And the last part of a negotiation is the last time, the last hours of a negotiation are usually when the deal gets done. So that's what we need to know. Don't get pushed into a corner at the last minute if you've got nowhere else to go. You need somewhere else to go.
Earlier you said that one should start the negotiation with a list of issues and make the first issues easy issues, easy agreements that you know you're going to come to an agreement on, because you know as you get into it, it'll get more important and probably tougher. But by building some rapport and momentum, it's more likely to push through the tough part. Is that the plan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anyone that follows sport or golf or anything knows that when a team's got momentum, things, magical things happen. And when things aren't going well and the press is against you and everything else, then it kind of, so a lot of it gets up here, gets in people's heads, and momentum is a pretty magic thing. So yeah, we all want momentum. We all want energy. And that's what we want into the deal. So the more we can psychologically control that, the better off we'll be.
To be a better negotiator, what sort of self-talk, what messages should we be recycling in our brain so that we don't get confused or just get off track?
Well, first of all, we need positive self-talk, don't we? We need a clear goal, we need clear preparation, and we need positive self-talk, which brings me on to another point. You should always take someone with you to an important negotiation. And if it's on Zoom, they can be on the call. And the reason you should do that is you need a bit of moral support. If they're attacking you, you need someone on your side. So that's the first thing, because, you know, it's very difficult because we all get negative self-talk. That's a natural thing. I think it's a human defense mechanism. And we need to be boosted up by other people. And so you need someone you can trust on your team, your trusted advisor. And we can use, if they're attacking us, I think the title of my book's a great thing to say to people, and with a statement followed by a yes to a question, which would be, George, just want to clarify one thing. You do want a win-win out of this, don't you? Notice the yes to a question at the end, and a yes to a question makes people think yes, even if they don't say yes. So it's an influencing question. Now, George, if you really are forced into saying yes to that, but if you don't say yes, or if you move back, fold your arms, I know that's a no, even if you're saying yes, and I know that's an objection that I have to overcome. So we get a huge amount of information from body language, which generally people don't pick up, and your observer, your colleague, your trusted advisor that's with you is there to pick up the body language when you take a break, when you take a time out, or as the Americans at Harvard call it, going to the balcony, whatever we want to call it, have a break, think it through, get your brain back into gear. That's what we need to do.
Oh, that's interesting. So one of the tactics or techniques should be always be willing to call a timeout.
Absolutely. Vital. Take someone with you, to call a timeout and ask them what they're seeing, what they're hearing, what they're feeling out of this. And therefore, what do you think we should do next? You don't need to do it yourself, but when you're under that pressure, when you're in the arena, when you're in the circus, you can't think straight. That's the way it is. That's human nature. Because sometimes people say to me, Derek, can you teach me how to think on my feet? And I say, no, I can't. Because in a pressured situation, you shouldn't think on your feet. You should take a break. You should take a time out. You should sleep on it. Where does the word sleeping on things come? Because we want our brain to assimilate all this information while we're asleep, because our brain never goes to sleep. And that's why often we wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning in the shower, driving to work in the morning or whatever. When we're switched away from the issue, suddenly we have these Edison called it light bulb moments, didn't he? Or Einstein called it different moments, etc. So all the geniuses knew, they got their best ideas when they sat back from the problem.
Derek, if you had few key points to tell people who maybe think they're a great negotiator, or people who are reluctant to negotiate, but they need to because it's part of their job, depends on it. If you could give them a few key tips to get them going in the right direction, what would those be?
Well, the first thing, George, would be to ask themselves, how good is good enough? Okay. How good is good enough? So I ask people to score themselves on a scale of 0 to 100. Where are you as a negotiator? First number that comes into your head. And this morning, people were scoring themselves at about 70 on average on this Zoom call. And I said, well, how much better would you be if you were a 75 or an 80? And then I said to them, well, this is my score sheet that's in Win-Win. Score yourself in the book on this, on these 12 points. Preparation, first impressions, questioning, listening, using your brain, your head, body language, lying, tactics, influencing, bargaining, conflict, and confidence. That's all explained in there. See how your score comes out because it's multiplied by different factors. And then you can look and see what you ought to improve. And George, usually comes out people, these macho negotiators often aren't very good at reading the body language, reading the signals, what's said, what's not said, reading between the lines, etc. I'll leave that up there in case anybody watching this wants to take a picture of it. With cameras are great now, aren't they? Mobile phones are great. You can take a picture of anything like that. And then I'd say to them, the third thing really is, if you don't ask, you don't get, but it's how you ask, which is the thing. Dropping your voice, tonality, asking it in a nice way, not in an aggressive way. You know, what can we do? You know, I'm just wondering what we can do to resolve this. What a great question. What can we do to resolve this? What are you looking for out of this deal? How can we get a little bit closer to an agreement? These are just good, soft, nice questions. And in my own mind, George, this is the secret. When you've asked a soft, nice, short question, up in my brain comes a question mark, and that question mark tells me to shut up. Because that's the trick. When you do say to someone, well, how much are you prepared to pay? You need to shut up. Because you want to hear their answer. You don't want to make it easier for them by carrying on talking. They're my three top tips for you, for your clients, for the people watching YouTube and listening to this on your fantastic podcast.
Derek, that's an appropriate note to wrap up on. So ask those soft key questions and then shut up. My guest today is Derek Arden, a negotiation expert who speaks and trains around the world. Look for his book, Win-Win, to discover how you can be a more powerful negotiator. And remember, when it's time to flinch,
if you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.